Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now continuing my foray into the book of Judges. I'm going to do today Judges chapter 4, verses 1 through 24, the entire chapter. This concerns the famous story of Deborah and Barak. Our context is this. In chapter 3, the author of the book of Judges discusses the first three judges, Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. Othniel, who beat the Canaanite king Cushan-Rishathaim, who was the son-in-law of Caleb. Not Cushan was, Othniel was the son-in-law of Canaan, of Caleb. And then Ehud, the famous left-handed judge who stabbed the fat king of Moab and killed him. And then Shamgar, who killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. So now we start in chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, after Ehud died. And the Lord told them, sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. The sons of Israel cried to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. Now, there's one thing we're going to see as we go through this chapter, that an understanding of the geography is pretty important. So let's go through and do some geography real quick here. We got Jabin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. He's the enemy of the Israelites. If you look at the map and find the Sea of Galilee and go north of the Sea of Galilee a few miles, you see Lake Hula. Well, halfway up the Jordan River there between the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula is the city of Hazor on the west bank of the Jordan. Now, Sisera lived in a place called Harosheth Hagoyim, which is not marked on the map. It's somewhere around the area there of Hazor. King James has it as Harosheth of the Gentiles. You see the word goyim in there, Gentiles, famous Jewish word. Oh, don't marry a goyim. Now, here is a quote from one of my commentators. This place had its name either because it was built by some of various nations, goyim nations, or inhabited by workmen of different countries, or rather it was a wood, originally, as the name signifies, to which many of the seven nations of the Canaanites fled from before Joshua, and hid and sheltered themselves, and in process of time built strong towers and fortresses in it, and became numerous and powerful. Well, that's all a nice speculation. Nobody really knows what it is. The fact that it's wood, according to this commentator, whose name I didn't write down, unfortunately, wood of the Gentiles. Easton says it. The word Harosheth means smithy of the Gentiles. Let's read what Easton says. Harosheth Goyim was a city near Hazor, as I've already said. In Galilee of the Gentiles, or Upper Galilee, that's north of the Sea of Galilee, it was here that Jabin's great army was marshaled before it went forth into the great battlefield of Esdraelon, that's the Valley of Jezreel, to encounter the army of Israel, by which it was routed and put to flight. We're going to be reading about that in this chapter. It was situated at the entrance of the pass to Esdraelon from the plain of Acher at the base of Carmel. Well, that's the pass. The Jezreel Valley starts at the bottom of Carmel and runs southeast till it gets to the Jordan Valley, right there at Mount Tabor. And the city itself, Harosheth Goyim, is near Hazor, which is, as I say, halfway between the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula, going to the north. The name in the Hebrew is Harosheth HaKohim, i.e. the smithy of the nations, probably. It is probably called that because of Jabin's iron war chariots, which were armed with scythes. We're going to talk about these war chariots in a minute. Verse 3. There were 900 of them. Well, I'll talk about it right now. The sons of Israel cried to the Lord. Why? Because this Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor, he had 900 iron chariots. Now, the chariots could not be of solid iron because they wouldn't be able to move. No horse can pull a solid iron chariot, not to mention the cost of building such a thing. 900 of them. It's referring to probably the iron scythes or the sharp blades that projected from the axles on each side of the chariots to hamstring horses and to slice up soldiers as the chariots were pulled forward. Clark says this idea that the iron refers to the scythe sticking out of the axles is quote-unquote generally supposed. Well, now, who is this Jabin? Well, he's king of Canaan. Now, this is Canaan in the particular sense, not the land of Canaan in general, which is oftentimes all the pagan tribes are sometimes called Canaanites as a general term. But this is the particular tribe of the Canaanites. You recall they're the ones that lived on the Mediterranean coast north of Acre, north of Mount Carmel, up through Tyre, up through Sidon, all along that area. Well, you can look, if you look at the map, that's just west, going from Lake Hula and a little bit north of Lake Hula. Go north of Lake Hula, you get to Mount Hermon. Well, all of that's in the northern part of Israel. So this is the area of the Canaanites, is what I'm saying. And so Jabin, a Canaanite, had his capital at Hazor. Now, there's a problem here, because in Joshua, the previous book, there was a king named Jabin, and he was also king of a city named Hazor. And Joshua killed this Jabin, and he burnt Hazor. So why are we dealing with Jabin and Hazor now, a couple of generations later after Joshua? Well, let's look at some options concerning Hazor. It could mean the country around Hazor. Hazor is meant as the place where Jabin was the king of. Or it could have been Hazor just been simply rebuilt. It doesn't take long to rebuild a city. As I've discovered at looking at ancient cities that get knocked down by earthquakes, they get rebuilt fairly quickly, which is really amazing. And as far as Jabin, he's probably just a descendant of the Jabin in Joshua, as Clark says. As a matter of fact, Jabin is a name common to the kings of Canaan. So that's not a problem at all. Now in verse 1, it says, the sons of Israel again did evil. Well, isn't that great? They just entered into a period of long rest and peace because of the victories of Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. And the latest victories were Shamgar, and especially Ehud. And to reward God's blessing of peace, they decided to go out and do evil again. And that evil is probably, it doesn't really say what the evil is, but it's probably worshiping idols and shacking up with Canaanite women, or marrying them, I should say. Now notice it says the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. Well, the third judge was Shamgar. Ehud was only the second judge, so why is Shamgar not mentioned? Well, some people say Shamgar is not mentioned because Shamgar's time of judging was very short. Some people say that the people fell into sin before Shamgar became judge, just as soon as Ehud was dead, and so that's why the time frame is marked by Ehud dying, not Shamgar, because when Ehud died, that's when everybody got into sin again. I think that's reasonable. Another idea is maybe it's because Shamgar was in a different location. He took care of the Philistines who were in the west, and Deborah took care of Jabin the Canaanite at maybe roughly the same time, a little bit after. And so since we're now talking about the situation of the Canaanites, which doesn't deal with the Philistines, maybe the Shamgar, the conqueror of the Philistines, is not mentioned. Adam Clark cast doubt on this. He says, why not when Shamgar was dead instead of when Ehud was dead? Does this not intimate that Shamgar was not reckoned in the number of the judges? Well, that's a technical point. Yeah, we're going to call him a judge. We're going to call him judge number 3. We now move to Judges chapter 4, verses 4 through 6. Now, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lappidoth, was judging Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali, and from the sons of Zebulun. I think I pronounced Naphtali wrong. It's Naphtali or Naphtali, your choice, but it's not Naphtali. 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 Naphtali or Naphtali. Well, where is Naphtali and Zebulun? If you look at the map again, find the Sea of Galilee, and then a little bit north of the Sea of Galilee is Lake Hula. Use that for your reference point and start moving west. The first, and the area between those two seas and the Mediterranean Sea is divided in half into two long strips. Naphtali is the easternmost, and Asher on the coast of the Mediterranean is the westernmost. Now, if you look at Naphtali and you go to the southwest of Naphtali, you see the little tribe of Zebulun, which is, its southern boundary was right on the Kishon River, which ran right through the Jezreel Valley, the Valley of Esdraelon, famous place where Megiddo is and the so-called Battle of Armageddon is going to take place. So Zebulun is there. And then if you go a little bit to the southeast of Zebulun, there's a little tribe of Issachar, which is there. It's at the southwestern tip of the Sea of Galilee. And it is the easternmost of the tribes as you go down the Kishon River, the Jezreel Valley. So now, where's Mount Tabor? Well, if you find the Sea of Galilee, go, I think it's 11 miles or so, 10 or 11 miles to the west of the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. It's really easy to locate as Mount Tabor. Now, Mount Tabor was right at the intersection of Naphtali on the southern end of that tribe, on the northwest corner of Zebulun, and the northern tip of Issachar. So it was right there in a strategic place. These are the places from which Barak is going to get his troops in order to fight Jabin, the king of Hazor. Now, verse 4 says, Deborah was a prophetess. Deborah means bee, by the way. I don't know why you would name a girl bee, but that's what her name is. She was the wife of Lapidoth, that is unknown, an unknown man. And that might not be the proper translation. There are other options to translate. It could be Deborah of Lapidoth, which means it's an unknown area. Or it could be translated as Deborah, a woman of splendors. So we don't know. She was judging Israel at that time. The NIV has, she was leading Israel at that time. She's building up a following out of the notice of Jabin. Jabin is to the north in Hazor, right south of Lake Hula, north of the Sea of Galilee. But where's Deborah? Well, I haven't mentioned that yet. She sat under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in verse 4. That's way down to the south here. Both of them are in the tribe of Benjamin. Ramah is about 8 miles due north of Jerusalem, and Bethel is about 6 miles north of Ramah, according to BibleAtlas.org. And she's halfway in between those cities, so she's about 7 miles north of Jerusalem. That's way down to the south. And so she's building up a military threat, if you will, out of the sight of Jabin, who's way up there in Hazor. Now, Adam Clark says about the fact that she was judging in verse 4, NIV says leading. This is what Clark says, quote, "This is, I believe, the first instance of gynecocrazy, whew, that's a made-up word, I believe, or female government on record. Deborah seems to have been supreme both in civil and religious affairs, and Lapidoth, her husband, appears to have had no hand in the government. But the original may as well be translated as a woman of Lapidoth, as being translated the wife of Lapidoth, as I've already mentioned." Now, we're going to talk about Deborah being a woman leader, because, you know, the feminists love that. But I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. I'll hold it. She was operating, judging under the palm tree of Deborah, and I assume it means judging. I mean, she's handling legal cases. The palm tree of Deborah might have been named the palm tree of Deborah, because that's where she chose to do her judging, and they just named the palm tree after her. Some people say it could be named after Deborah, Rebecca's nurse, because, if you recall, Rebecca died near Ramah, weeping in Ramah. She died before she could get back further south with Jacob, unfortunately. Died giving birth to Benjamin. But for whatever reason, that's just an instance of, that's just an historical incident of interest. Doesn't really matter. Now, in verse 6, she said she summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kedesh Naphtali. Now, where is Kedesh Naphtali? Well, this is, Kedesh is really easy to see. If you, it's normally just called Kedesh. You go to Lake Hula, which is right north of the Sea of Galilee. You go about 4 miles to the northwest of Lake Hula, and there's Kedesh. It's called Kedesh Naphtali here because Kedesh is in the tribe of Naphtali, and that would help distinguish it from another Kedesh, which is further south on the Sea of Galilee. By the way, I've traveled through that area on a tour of Israel, and when we got to where I thought Lake Hula would be, I asked the tour guide, "What happened to Lake Hula? I don't see it." She says, "Oh, that's long been gone. The thirsty modern Israelites have sucked the lake dry trying to provide water to that arid region, and so Lake Hula is gone now." But if you'll look at the map again, Barak is north of Hazor. He's north of Lake Hula. Hazor, where Jabin was, the Canaanite, is south of there in the Jordan Valley, but not far. So I assume that Deborah sent messengers that just did an in run around Hazor, just went around it where Jabin wouldn't know what was going on. Let's read a little bit about Kedesh. It was a, quote, fenced city of Naphtali, one of the cities of refuge. The Levites owned 6 cities of refuge where the manslayer could run, if you recall. It was assigned to the Gershonite Levites. There's 3 families in Levi. Gershon is one, Merari and Kohath are the other two. So the Gershonite Levites had Kedesh. It was originally a Canaanite royal city and was the residence of Barak, as we just found out. And here he and Deborah assembled the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali before the commencement of the conflict with Sisera in the plain of Esdraelon. They assembled them there in Kedesh, and then they marched south to Mount Tabor, which is right at the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. And that's enough from Easton's. I don't want to read any more of that. I will say this. I have been confused for a long time between Kedesh, K-E-D-E-S-H, and Kadesh, K-A-D-S-H, which is a little bit further north on the Orontes River in Koilesh, Syria, between the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon ranges. That was a very famous city because The most documented battle in ancient history in 1274 took place there at that Kadesh, K-A-D-E-S-H, between Egypt and the Hittites. It was put down on Egyptian monuments, and it was also, there was a peace treaty between the Egyptians and the Hittites that was found, and so this is so documented. You can, I mean, you read the history of this, and they will tell you where the troops went, who's on the left flank, who's on the right flank. Big famous city, famous battle, but that's not this Kadesh. Now Deborah told Barak, God, the God of Israel, the Lord, Yahweh, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor. Notice how firm that is, how strong and convinced Deborah Stone was. Remember, she was a prophetess. Now, here's what I'm going to talk about, what evangelical feminists like to say about Deborah. Oh, this shows that it was normative for women to lead men. Now, it's obvious that Deborah was leading men. She was judging them, that's leading them, delivering them, however you want to translate judge or interpret judge, probably handling legal cases, I wouldn't be surprised. And now she's taking it upon herself to provide leadership, military leadership, really, to get Israel out of its bind. Well, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. I've just stated the feminist case, and they love to talk about Deborah. First of all, she's an exception to the rule. Since when are exceptions? Do exceptions establish the rule? That's like people say, well, the women leaders in the New Testament, they were leaders. And what about the apostles? Where's the women leaders in the apostles? Oh, but Junia was an apostle. Well, except maybe you can translate it Junius. This is in Romans 12, I think it is. And even if she was a woman, even if it was, if that verse does not mean she is of note among the apostles. In other words, the apostles took note of Junia, a woman who was not an apostle. But even if you say she was an apostle, which I don't, isn't that sort of strange that she's the one exception out of all the scadzillions of male apostles that are found in the New Testament? Since when does the exception prove the rule? You got all these judges, only one of them's a woman. That's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that Deborah was operating out of necessity. She was operating in a sinful vacuum. There was no man who would lead. Men had abdicated their leadership. The one man who could lead, Barak, refused to. She offered it twice. She says, go do it. Oh, no, I'm not going to go unless you go. So, yes, when men abdicate, women have got no choice but to lead. That doesn't make it right. The time of the judges was rife with sin. All did what was right in their own eyes, and it is an error to take such a period and posit it as a norm for leadership. There was a lot of things out of whack. It reminds me of people who look at the Old Testament law and say, oh, this is terrible. You know, there was slavery, and there was polygamy, and there was easy divorce. That doesn't mean God was happy with those three things. It was just he was trying to regulate the nincompoops that he was trying to regulate. All right, that's the second argument, that female leadership is over men is not normative. Third argument, just because she was a great prophetess and a leader, that doesn't mean it was God's will. Abraham was a great leader, and he was a polygamist. Is God in favor of polygamy? I don't think so, not according to Jesus. David was a great leader, and he was a murderer and adulterer. I guarantee you God's not in favor of murder and adultery. And just because Deborah's a great prophetess, that don't mean he's in favor of female leadership. Fourth argument against female leadership over men. Most of the other judges were said to be raised up by the Lord. Othniel, Ehud, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson are all, they specifically stated to be, have been raised up by the Lord. But not so with Deborah. We read in Judges 4:4 in this chapter, Deborah, a woman who was a prophetess and the wife of Lappidoth, was judging Israel. It doesn't say she was raised up by God to be a judge. It just says she was judging Israel. I know that's an argument from silence, and it's not the strongest argument, but it's another little straw to put on the camel's back. Fifth argument against Deborah being used as a role model for female leadership over men. Deborah did not try to take leadership. She offered it to Barak. How many times have you seen evangelical feminists offer leadership to men? She took leadership because of male abdication. No other of the male judges ever offered up their leadership. They just did their judging thing, but not Deborah. Now you say, well, she's a woman, she couldn't lead the army. I don't know, Joan of Arc did. All right, I don't want to get my blood pumping too hard here. I really don't like evangelical feminism because it's ruined the church, it's ruined the family in America, it's ruined America. Feminism stinks. And I am tired of passive men who will not stand up and take a lead. I'm tired of a bunch of Christian young men who don't get married because they're too busy playing video games. Women do not. You know, I was just watching a YouTube video, not by a Christian, non-Christian, Wingman. she's trying to give men advice on how to deal with women, and she's a woman, so she knows better, so she got this YouTube video, and she's fascinating because she says women love to be protected and taken care of. I said, what? Somebody saying that in the 21st century? Oh, let me send her some money. Well, enough of that. Now let's talk a little bit about Mount Tabor, which Easton talks about, since we're getting ready to go there in the battle. It's a cone-like prominent mountain 11 miles west of the Sea of Galilee. It's the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. It is about 1,843 feet high. The view from the summit of it is said to be singularly extensive and grand. It was here that Barak encamped before the battle with Sisera. We're getting ready to go there in just a minute. There's an old tradition, which, however, is unfounded, that it was the scene of the transfiguration of our Lord. Now, I've heard that before. I remember being on the tour. Oh, look over there. That's Mount Tabor. That's the Mount of Transfiguration. You can't listen to everything a tour guide tells you. They love to put labels on places and say, this George Washington slept here. Well, whoop-de-doo. Anyway. The prominence and isolation of Tabor, standing as it does on the borderline between the northern and southern tribes, between the mountains and the central plain, that's because it was right north of the Jezreel Valley, made it a place of note in all ages and evidently led the psalmist to associate it with Hermon, the one emblematic of the south. Hermon, of course, would be the north, which, because that's further north, right up in the southern tip of the Anti-Lebanon Range. There are some who still hold that this was the scene of the Transfiguration, so let's give people credit. Maybe it was the scene of Transfiguration, but that's just speculation. We don't know. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Mount Tabor was right near the point where the three tribes, Issachar, Zebulun, and Naphtali, came together at a point. Josephus has an interesting statement. He says that on top of Mount Tabor, there was a plain about 3 miles long surrounded by a wall, and so Sisera could easily gather his troops there. I shouldn't say Sisera, Barak could gather his troops there, because that's what he's doing. Mount Tabor is at the northeast corner of the Plain of Esdraelon. The Plain of Esdraelon is the same thing as the Valley of Jezreel, where the so-called future Battle of Armageddon is going to take place, which I don't believe because I'm an Orthodox preterist and not a futurist. Now, Naphtali and Zebulun are mentioned here in verse 6, where Deborah tells Barak that God has commanded him to take 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun, because those are the two closest tribes. It doesn't mention Issachar, but Naphtali and Zebulun are very close by. We go now to Judges 4:7. This is referring to Yahweh speaking, I, Yahweh, will draw out to you, this is Deborah quoting Yahweh because she's a prophetess, Yahweh will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand. Now, how is God going to draw out Sisera? Here's what Benson says, quote, by my secret and powerful providence, ordering and overruling his, Sisera's, inclinations. Colin Delitzsch basically say the same thing. So God is going to supernaturally urge Sisera, not against his will, of course. Sisera's going to voluntarily go out there, but God's going to superintend it. And he's going to draw Sisera with all of his troops and his 900 chariots to the river Kishon, or the brook Kishon. That's the brook that runs right down the Jezreel Valley, the Valley of Esdraelon. It's a flat area, and I will give him into your hand. Now, it doesn't say exactly where the battle took place, but I've been at Megiddo looking over. Megiddo's a little bit to the north, northwest of where we are now at Mount Tabor. Tabor's on the other side of the valley. Megiddo's on the southern side of the valley, and you look across the plain of Jezreel, and you can see for 5 trillion miles. It just goes on forever and ever, and it's flat as a pancake. Perfect place for battle. And remember, Barak's up on Mount Tabor, so he's going to come flying down off that mountain and clobber Sisera in the valley. Now let's look at this river Kishon, or brook Kishon. This is what Easton's dictionary says about it. It means winding. The word Kishon means winding. A winter torrent of central Palestine, which rises about the roots of Tabor and Gilboa. Gilboa is where Saul died in his battle. We'll see later on in Kings. It's nearby. And the brook rises up right at the bottom of Tabor, and it runs northwest until it dumps into the Mediterranean Sea. I always thought it came the other way, but that's not true. It goes into the Mediterranean Sea. So the brook passes in a northerly direction through the plains of Esdraelon, that's the Valley of Jezreel, and Acher, which is at the end right there on the Mediterranean coast. Acher is on the northern side of the Bay of Acher. Carmel, Mount Carmel, is on the southern side, present-day Haifa, on the southern side of that bay. So the brook falls into the Mediterranean at the northeastern corner of the Bay of Acher at the foot of Carmel. It is the drain by which the waters of the plain of Esdraelon and of the mountains that surround it find their way into the sea. The modern name, the Arabic name, is the River of Slaughter. In the triumphal song of Deborah, it is spoken of as that ancient river, either because it had flowed on for ages or because it was the torrent into which were shown signs and wonders to Israel of old. That's just a speculation as to why Deborah called it the ancient river. Or as another option, it was called the ancient river, probably because the references to the exploits in that region among the ancient Canaanites. For the adjoining plain of Esdraelon was the great battlefield of Palestine, as I just said. So maybe it's referring to that, Deborah is referring to that ancient river where the Israelites whipped up on Canaanites in the past. When the Kishon was at its height, it would be, partly on account of its quicksands, as impassable as the ocean itself to a retreating army. Well, we don't know the details of the battle, but that kind of gives you an idea of what's down there. Mount Tabor, Kishon, and the plain, the Valley of Jezreel. Judges 4, 8 through 10, then Barak said to Deborah, "If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." She said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman." Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kedesh. That's his hometown, Barak's hometown, 4 miles northwest of Lake Hula. Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kedesh, and 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went up with him. So they gathered the troops up there at Kedesh, north of Hazor, which is in the Jordan Valley, south of Lake Hula. They are, Deborah and Barak, and the troops are northwest of Lake Hula. Now let's look at this phrase in verse 8. Barak said to her, "If you will go with me." Now what state of mind is Barak showing here? Is he showing lack of faith? Well, that's sort of hard to say, because Barak is written up in the Hebrews Faith Hall of Fame, Hebrews 11:32. "And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets." So he's mentioned in as a hero of faith in Hebrews 11:32. And as a matter of fact, even though he didn't go right then, but when Deborah said she'd go, he did go. He showed faith in the word of God from Deborah. He said, "I believe you as a prophetess. I will go." That doesn't show a lack of faith. And besides, he was fighting a tough hombre. Jabin had 900 chariots. This was going to be a tough battle. He went. So we're going to say that, hey, if I don't have faith, I don't think so. I think it makes more sense to say that the reason that Barak wanted Deborah to go, "If you will go with me, Deborah, I'll go," is because he wanted Deborah's spirituality. He regarded her as a prophetess. He wanted her to pray for him, to give him advice and counsel. He wanted him to help persuade the Naphtalites and the Zebulunites, because Deborah's reputation would be greatly persuasive. After all, she was a judge in Israel. So that's why he wanted her to go. Not because he was afraid to go without her, but he wanted her spirituality. Or not because he was afraid to go, period. It was because he wanted her to go as a prophetess. Now, Deborah didn't hesitate. She said in verse 9, "I will surely go with you." That's the good news. But the bad news is that when you win, Barak, you're going to lose honor to a woman. Now, who is that woman? Some people say it's Deborah. I don't think so. I think it's Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, who stabbed Sisera in the temple with a tent peg, as we're going to see in just a minute. That's who the honor is going to go to. Now, I will say this. The fact that Deborah said that Barak was going to lose some honor sort of casts some shade on Barak, and it sounds like, "Barak, you're hesitating to go. Maybe you should have gone a little bit quicker." That, to me, is a close question, because, as I said, Barak doesn't look like a coward. He doesn't look like a man who doesn't have any faith here, and yet it seems that Deborah's casting shade on him. However, you could say that Deborah's just stating a matter of fact. "Well, you're going to win, but sorry to tell you, I've got a prophecy here. It's going to be a woman that's going to take out Sisera, not you." Now, you know, if Barak is a humble guy, he doesn't care who gets to go. He just wants to win. So I don't know. You can read between the lines here and say that Barak is a coward. He's abdicating leadership and so forth. I don't think so. That's just my humble opinion. All right, so Barak, 10,000 men of Naphtali and Kedesh, Naphtali and Zebulun go up to Kedesh, and Deborah goes up. Verse 10 says that Barak called all those people from Zebulun and Naphtali up to Kedesh. That could either be through a trumpet call or maybe just call sending some messengers. The 10,000 troops that were up there were all infantry. They had no chariots, as did Jabin, the king of Hazor, the Canaanite king of Hazor. We go down to Judges 4, verse 11. Now Heber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zaananim. Zaananim. That sounds like Tiananmen Square. Zaananim, which is near Kedesh. Well, the oak in Zaananim, that's unknown otherwise, except it's near Kedesh. It means oaks of the wanderers, for what that's worth. So that's where Heber the Kenite is living. So he's in the general area. Now, the Kenites, who were they? They show up a lot in the scriptures. I'm going to give you a good summary from gotquestions.org. The Kenites were friendly to Moses and the Israelites during the time of the Exodus. It seems that Jethro, Hobab, and other Kenites joined with Moses and traveled all the way to Canaan with the people of God. Now, Jethro, well, if you'll look at Mount Sinai, the traditional site of Mount Sinai in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula, and then go east and hop over the Gulf of Aqaba in southern Jordan, present-day southern Jordan or northern Saudi Arabia, in that area, that's where the Kenites were. And Moses was banished there when he killed the Egyptian, and he was running, and he married the Kenite Jethro's daughter, Zipporah, and Zipporah had a brother named Hobab. So Hobab was his brother-in-law. Now, when Moses had brought the people out of Israel and gotten right back around, right near Mount Sinai, which is close to his home stomping grounds of the Kenites, he invited them to go on up with him to Canaan. I'll read you that verse in a minute. So the Kenites, Jethro, Hobab, apparently, is we don't know exactly how many of the Kenites went, but Jethro, Hobab, and the other Kenites joined with Moses, traveled all the way to Canaan with the people of God. The Kenites settled near Jericho. That's after they crossed under Joshua. They eventually moved south to live in the desert region of Negev, actually south of Arad, which is way down there in the Negev. But that's where the Kenites are. But now we're way up north of Kadesh, north of Lake Hula. How did that happen? However, gotquestions.org continues, a Kenite named Heber stayed in Canaan. He didn't go down to the Negev. He didn't go down to Arad. He migrated north to near Kedesh. It was Heber's wife Jael who killed Sisera during the time of Deborah and Barak. All right, to finish off the story of the Kenites, during Saul's reign, God instructed Israel to destroy the Amalekites, but the Kenites who were living with the Amalekites in the southern Negev, Saul, before he attacked, said to the Kenites, go away, leave the Amalekites so that I do not destroy you along with them. For you showed kindness to all the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt. So that's roughly the story of the Kenites. Easterns has another interesting detail. It says that Kenites means smiths. They were the wandering smiths, the gypsies and traveling tinkers of the old Oriental world. They formed an important guild in an age when the art of metallurgy was confined to a few. And by the way, Jethro is called a Midianite in Numbers 10, verse 29, so many people think the Midianites were the same as the Kenites. Now, all of this is a tremendous amount of detail to describe a parenthetical statement. Now, Heber the Kenite. And we need to distinguish Heber from Hobab, because Hobab is mentioned here. The Kenites, the family background of the Kenites, are mentioned in this verse merely as parenthetical detail to describe who Heber the Kenite was. Now, Heber the Kenite had separated himself. That's because he didn't live in the south near Arad in the Negev. He had gone all the way up north of Kadesh. That's how he separated himself. And it says here the Kenites were the sons of Hobab. Now, Hobab was the brother-in-law of Moses. But here in verse 11 in ESB, it says that Hobab is the father-in-law of Moses. Well, that can't be. So how do we solve that problem? Two ways to solve it. The easiest way is the phrase should be translated brother-in-law. Ellicott says this, rather, brother-in-law. The names for these relationships are closely allied. In other words, it's a translation problem. Other translations, as a matter of fact, do translate it as brother-in-law. If you look at the American Standard Version or the New American Bible, it says, Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law. I sure wish that the NASB and the Holman Christian Study Bible had done that too. It would save me about 20 or 30 minutes of wandering around in commentaries. So we're going to assume that this is Hobab, the brother-in-law of Moses. Why? Because Moses married Zipporah and Hobab was Zipporah's brother. All right, rabbit trail. Go back to the battle here. Judges 4, 12 through 14. Then they, that's NASB translation, as usual, a bad translation or a hyper-literal translation that is confusing. The New American Bible, the Holman Christian Study Bible, says, it was reported to Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, it was reported to. God's word says, the report reached Sisera. Doesn't say who gave it to them. But no, the NASB says they told. Well, who's the they that it might be that told Sisera? Well, it could be the Canaanites that lived near Tabor, where the army of Barak had mustered. Of course, this area is very close. The distances are not great, so there's Canaanites everywhere. They could have easily found out. Could be Sisera got suspicious and sent spies out. It could be the Kenites had told Jabin. We'll see later the Kenites were in a peace treaty with Jabin, the Canaanites, and so they might have told him. Jagiel says whether the Kenites did this out of goodwill or ill will cannot be said, but why in the world would the Kenites tell Jabin, hey, you Canaanites are in trouble, Jabin. There's 10,000 troops gathered on Mount Tabor ready to whip your behind. I know that's bad, Will, if the Kenites did that. But remember, the Kenites are in a treaty with the Canaanites, and so that would be a reasonable thing. But it doesn't matter. Somehow the word got to Sisera that Barak was up on Mount Tabor. Verse 13, Sisera called together all his chariots, 900 iron chariots, and all the people who were with him from Harosheth Hagoyim, which is somewhere near Hazor there, right between Lake Hula and the Sea of Galilee, to the river Kishon, which is right to the, dumps into the Jordan Valley, right, or starts, not dumps into, but starts in the Jordan Valley right there at the base of Mount Tabor, which is 11 miles to the west of the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. So in other words, he gathered all the Canaanites from Hazor down to Tabor, to the Kishon Brook. Verse 14, Deborah said to Barak, arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. Now in verse 13, where it says that Sisera called together all his chariots, he had no choice. When he finds out that Barak has 10,000 soldiers on Mount Tabor, obviously Barak does not have peaceful intentions. He was obviously showing hostile intent. And so Sisera says, we're going to have to take care of this. And so down he goes. And when it says he went down to the river Kishon, it means that part of the river Kishon, which is at the foot of Mount Tabor. If you look at the map, this is real easy to see, not complicated. And verse 14, Deborah says, this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. That could just be a statement. This is the time. But it could be that she's given a specific day to attack. Prophetically, remember, she's a prophetess. And this is why Barak, in fact, Adam Clark says, this is why Barak wanted Deborah to come, to tell him when to attack, give him some military advice. Remember, Judges 4, verse 8, Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. I need your prophecy to go with me. Verse 14, she puts it in the past. This is the day that God has given. This is what always, prophets always say this. They speak of something in the future has already been done in the past because it just might as well have been. It's certain. It's in the bag. This is a precise day for the victory. Now in verse 14, Deborah says that the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. But now didn't Deborah earlier say that the honor was going to go to a woman instead of Barak for delivering Sisera? That Sisera would be delivered into a woman's hand in Judges 4, verse 9, first part of the verse. Deborah says, I will go with you, she said. But you will receive no honor on the road you are about to take, because the Lord will sell Sisera into a woman's hand. But here, in verse 14, she says, the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Well, it would be a quibble to say that that's a contradiction. Barak fell first into the hands, Sisera fell first into the hands of Jael, and then into the hand of Barak on the same day. In other words, Sisera fell into both of their hands. That's not a contradiction. Now, they went down from Mount Tabor, the army did, of Barak to 10,000 soldiers. Deborah stayed behind up on the mountain. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say this, quote, it is a striking proof of the full confidence Barak and his troops reposed in Deborah's assurance of victory, that they relinquished their advantageous position on the hill and rushed into the plain in face of the iron chariots they so much dreaded. Well, that's true. They wiped them out on the plain, not up on the mountain. Judges 4, verses 15 through 17. The Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. Remember, that's Sisera's hometown. And all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left. Now Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin the king of Hazor and the house of Heber the Kenite. Now, a little load on geography here. Hirsheth Hagoyim is close to Hazar and the Oak of Tanaim, where Heber the Kenite lived. That was near Kadesh. Those areas are close. You look at the map, they're quite close. We see God routing Sisera. Now, Josephus has an interesting comment quoted here by John Gill. Quote, Josephus says there was a great tempest of rain and hail, and the wind blew the rain in their faces, which so blinded their eyes that their slings and arrows were of no use to them, and that they bore armor were so, and they that bore armor were so benumbed that they could not hold their swords. Now that makes sense to me. That's how you wipe out a whole army, because not one was left, it says here in a minute. It says in verse 16, not one was left. That has to be a disaster, and wind and hail will do that to an army. Some, on the other hand, think that the Lord confounded Sisera with confusion, using a supernatural agency, so that all Barak had to do was pursue and kill. I don't think so. I think Josephus. And I don't know where Josephus got his information from, but it would be reasonable that that would be passed down to somewhere where he could get that information. Jameson Fawcett Brown says the Hebrew here says the Lord, quote, threw his army into wild confusion. So Sisera has got no choice but to get out of his chariot and hot-footed away from there. Why did he do that? Why did he go on foot? Well, he was probably fleet of foot. His chariot was in danger of being entangled with all the other fleeing chariots. He would look more like a common soldier. There's less chance someone would want to kill him. And, of course, if it was raining, the chariots would be bogged down. Now, when it says in verse 16 that not one, even one, was left, that, of course, except Sisera. He's the one that is left. Now, he goes to the tent of Heber the Kenite, whom he obviously knew. We'll see in a minute. He knew Jael, and he probably knew Jael's husband, who wasn't home at the time. Why did he go there? As I said, this is close by in the area of his hometown. Well, Sisera might think himself safer in a tent than in a town. That's probably true. A tent's probably out in the boonies a little bit. He probably thought that no one would ever search the tent of a woman, because women lived in separate tents in those times. And he went there probably because, as I said, the Kenites were neutral and friendly. Well, even though they were in a peace, they had a relationship of peace, verse 17, peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and Heber the Kenite. But they were also friendly with the Israelites, too, if you recall, when I talked about the Kenites. So this would be a perfect place to go, because even though they're friendly with the Israelites, that means that because they were friendly with the Israelites, that means the pursuing Israelite army might not think to find an enemy in there. Why would an enemy go to a pro-Israelite tent? But on the other hand, they were at peace because they had peace between Heber and Sisera's Canaanites, and so he thought, well, this is probably a good place to go. Jameson Fawcett Brown says about this choice of Sisera, quote, according to the usages of nomadic people, the duty of receiving the stranger in the sheik's absence devolves on his wife, and the moment the stranger is admitted into his tent, his claim to be defended or concealed from his pursuers is established. A little bit of Eastern hospitality there. He's in the sheik's tent. Nobody's going to go into the woman's tent to find him. Here's what Adam Clark says, quote, he preferred the woman's tent because of secrecy, for according to the etiquette of the Eastern countries, no person ever intrudes into the apartments of the women, and in every dwelling the women have a separate apartment. So that was not a bad move on Sisera's part. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out well for him. We turn now to Judges 4, verses 18 through 20. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, turn aside, my master, turn aside to me, do not be afraid. And he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. He said to her, please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty. So she opened a bottle of milk and gave him a drink. Then she covered him. He said to her, stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and inquires of you and says, is there anyone here? Then you shall say, no. Now in verse 18 it says, Jael went out to meet Sisera. This means that Jael knew Sisera. Most probably, she says, turn aside, my master. She's asking a strange man into her tent. She obviously knew him. She calls him master. That's because Sisera was a big shot general. Jael tells Sisera, don't be afraid. Now, perhaps at first she didn't have any intention to kill him, but after she saw him in the tent asleep, she thought, the Israelites have just won a smashing battle here. Sisera is by himself. He has no army. The Israelites come and they discover that I'm hiding the enemy general, they might not be too happy with me. Maybe she thought that thought later. Maybe she had that thought now, and she's just being duplicitous when she says, don't be afraid.
It's hard to say.
But she, at some point, is going to realize that she's putting herself in danger and her husband by shielding the enemy of Israel. Now, why did she cover him with a rug? It could be to hide him. Most probably is to keep him warm. And if it's true that Josephus is right, that the battle was won by Barak because of a hard driving rain, Sisera could very well be soaking wet. So she covers him up. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, Sisera reckoned on this as a pledge of his safety, especially in the tent of a friendly sheik. This pledge was the strongest that could be sought or obtained after he had partaken of refreshments and had been introduced in the inner or women's apartment. He was welcomed in. He was given milk. He was covered in a rug. He was given hospitality. Usually in the East, that means you are safe. You are in a sacrosanct place. Nobody's going to touch you. Now, Sisera asked for water. Jael gives him milk. Why did she do that? Well, maybe it was just she was being courteous because milk is better than water. It could be that milk makes one sleepy, and if Sisera is sleepy, that would further Jael's designs to kill him. However, I don't think that's really true because I think Sisera was probably so sleepy anyway. He just fought a long battle and lost it. He'd been on the run. He didn't need to be sleepier than he already was. Another option, it might be she wanted to increase Sisera's confidence and security to make it easier for her to kill him later. Well, we can speculate all we want on that. Sisera goes to sleep. Before he goes to sleep, he says in verse 20, how about standing at the door of the tent, Jael, in case anybody comes and inquires and asks, where is this guy, Sisera? Or is anybody here? Of course, that's just a precaution against getting caught while he's sleeping. Now, when he tells Jael to stand in the doorway, in the flat text that we read, we don't know what his tone of voice was. Could it be imperious or commanding? Stand in the doorway, Jael. I don't think so. I don't think Sisera is in any shape to be commanding and imperious at that point. He's worn out. He was probably being very polite and entreating. He's lost his whole army. He's in danger of his life, and he's going to be ordering people around? I don't think so. But if Jael had just done that, if she'd have just stood there and anybody come by, you seen Sisera? No. Nobody's going to look in a woman's tent, not in that culture. So he did the best he could to cover himself. Unfortunately, when you don't have an army and when you just got beat, people are going to turn on you, and that's what Jael did. We go now to verses 21 through 24 of Judges 4, and we will finish this audio. But Jael, Heber's wife, that's Heber the Kenite, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand and went secretly to him, to Sisera, and drove the peg into his temple, and it went through into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted. Well, at least he died without pain. So he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet Barak, and said to him, come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking. So it looks to me that Jael wanted some good cred with Barak. So that's why she went out and said, I got him, I got him, I got him. And he, Barak, entered with Jael, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with a tent peg in his temple. So God subdued on that day Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the sons of Israel. At that point, I guess, Barak knew that Deborah's prophecy was true, that the honor of the kill was going to a woman, namely Jael. Verse 24, the hand of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. Of course, once Sisera's gone, there's not much left for Jabin. It's a matter of time before he's defeated. Now we go to a great theological question. Was Jael actuated by malice when she killed Sisera? Or was she motivated by self-interest in the fact that it would look bad for her to be shielding an enemy of Israel? Was she trying to protect herself, in other words? Or, third option, maybe she was concerned for the glory of God and the interest of God's people, if you want to put a nice spin on it. We'll talk about that a little bit more in just a minute. Notice she grabbed a tent peg. Somebody has speculated that she was probably very used to driving tent pegs in the ground as they moved their tents around. I guess the women helped with that kind of work. I don't know. But let's get to the point. Was Jael justified in what she did? Now, I'm going to read you a long list of circumstances which made it appear that what she did was exceedingly questionable. The commentators split on this all over the place. So let's look at some things that make it look dicey what she did. First, there was peace between her family and the king of Canaan, but she kills the general of Canaan. Peace was no doubt made, as all transactions of the kind were, with a sacrifice and an oath. I sacrifice an animal, and I swear I'm not going to hurt you, Jabin. Canaanites, but she did it. Sisera came to her tent with the utmost confidence because they were at peace, because the Canaanites were at peace with the Kenites. Jael met Sisera with the most friendly greetings and assurances of safety. Having asked for water to show her friendship and respect, she gave him cream, and that was in a vessel suitable to his dignity. I don't know how people know that, but I guess that's a speculation. She put him in the secret part of her own tent and covered him in such a way as to evidence her good faith and to inspire him with the greater confidence. She agreed to keep watch at the door and to deny his being there to any that might inquire. She gave him permission to secrete himself with her and gave him refreshment. She was bound by the rules of Asiatic hospitality to have defended his life even at the risk of her own. She took the advantage of his weariness and deep sleep and took away his life. She exulted in her deed, met Barak, and showed him in triumph what she had done. And the author of the book of Judges does not offer one word in her defense. Well, that doesn't look good, does it? But now let's look at some facts that make Jael look a little bit better. First of all, Deborah, a prophetess, declares her blessed above women. That's in the next chapter in the Song of Deborah and Barak. So that makes it sound like Jael's actions were sanctioned by God, because Jael is blessed above all women. Also in Jael's defense, Sisera was fighting for an evil cause, kind of like Rommel. You can be sympathetic with Rommel, as I am, but he was fighting for the Nazis. That was his big problem. Now, I'm going to read you some commentators who defend Jael. First is Poole, Matthew Poole. Quote, that artifice that he asked water and she gave him milk, which, if impartially examined, will be found to differ but little from that of warlike stratagems, wherein a man lays a snare for his enemy and deceives him with pretenses of doing something which he never intends. And Sisera, though for the time he pretended to be a friend, yet was in truth a bitter and implacable enemy unto God and all his people, and consequently to Jael herself. So Matthew Poole basically says it was a stratagem of war. It was war. The general got killed. He got killed in warfare. So quit complaining about what Jael did. Here's what the pulpit commentary says again in defense of Jael. Quote, it is impossible for us to view Jael's act in the same light as her contemporaries did on account of its treachery and cruelty. Well, that sounds like the pulpit commentary is against Jael. But let's continue. The commentary says this, but we can admire her faith in the God of Israel, her love for the people of God, and her marvelous courage and strength of mind in carrying out her purpose, and make allowance for the age in which she lived. So this defense of Jael is, well, that's just the way it was back then. Times were tough. Things were not gentle. It was a walking dead society, so what she did was not all that bad. Now let's look at some commentators that condemn Jael. Here's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, but the taking of his life by the hand of Jael was murder. It was a direct violation of all the notions of honor and friendship that are usually held sacred among pastoral people, and for which it is impossible to conceive a woman in Jael's circumstances to have had any motive except that of gaining favor with the victors. Though predicted by Deborah in Judges 4:9, it was the result of divine foreknowledge only, not the divine appointment or sanction, and though it is praised in the song in Judges 5, the eulogy must be considered as pronounced not on the moral character of the woman and her deed, but on the public benefits which, in the overruling providence of God, would flow from it. Okay, that's the first witness for the prosecution. Let's see what Adam Clark says. Quote, to say, as has been done in the case of Eglon, that Sisera was a public enemy and any of the people whom he oppressed might be justified in taking away his life, is a very dangerous position, as it refers one of the most solemn acts of judgment and justice to the caprice or prejudice or enthusiastic feeling of every individual who may persuade himself that he is not only concerned in the business, but authorized by God to take vengeance by his own hand. So Clark says this is an act of private vengeance. I don't think it's vengeance. Sisera never had done anything to Jael to make her want to get private revenge. This was a military act, in my humble opinion. Clark continues, while justice and law are in the world, God never will, and he never did, abandon cases of this kind to the caprice, prejudice, or party feeling of any man. The conduct of Ehud and Jael are before the tribunal of God. I will not justify, I dare not absolutely condemn, there I leave them. So Clark's a little bit ambivalent. He doesn't like what happened. He doesn't like what Jael did, but he says, I'm not going to condemn her, but I'm telling you, it's suspicious. Here's what Ellicott says, quote, Many commentators have ventured to assume that at this instant Jael received a divine intimation of what she was to do. To make such an assumption as a way of defending an act of assassination peculiarly terrible and peculiarly treacherous seems to be to the last degree unwarrantable. If any readers choose to adopt such methods for themselves, they ought not to attempt the enforcement of such, quote-unquote, private interpretations on others. The mind which is unsophisticated by the casuistry of exegesis will find little difficulty in arriving at a fair estimate of Jael's conduct without resorting to dangerous and arbitrary interpolations of supposition into the simple scripture narrative. In other words, Ellicott saying, well, if you're going to justify what she did, fine, but it's only for her, not for you. You don't go around thinking you can kill somebody. Well, I agree with that. No problem with that. It was warfare. Well, I'm going to give my little opinion here for what it's worth. I have never once thought the Jael did anything wrong with what she did. Sure, she saved her life, but she also got rid of a horrible enemy of Israel, and it wasn't a military situation. She didn't kill him for private reasons. She killed him because he was a general. But a lot of people disagree with me on that, so I report, you decide. Why did she use a tent peg? This is a minor detail. Why did she use a tent peg instead of a sword or something? Well, maybe the women didn't have swords around, or maybe the Kenites themselves didn't have weapons, although I find that hard to believe. Notice how easy this was for Jael to kill Sisera, because he was worn out and exhausted, which means he was sleeping like a rock, so he couldn't hear anything, didn't have any feel that he was about to get pegged. Now, when Barak shows up in verse 22 and Jael goes out and says, hey, here he is, how does Barak feel about that? Here's Adam Clark's suggestion, his speculation, quote, what impression this made on the victorious Barak is not said. It could not give him much pleasure, especially when he learned the circumstances of his death. Really? Mr. Clark, are you trying to tell me that the man comes up, he finds his opposing enemy dead, the enemy is killed, no more further battle, no more need to chase, and Barak is supposed to be disappointed about that? Maybe Clark is thinking that Barak was worried that a woman stole his honor. Do we really think that much about Barak? He's already been told that a woman was going to steal his honor by Deborah, the prophetess. That didn't seem to bother him then, and I can't believe it bothers him now. He won. He's a victorious general. Why is he going to be disappointed? Because seeing Sisera there with a tent peg through his temple. Well, ladies and gentlemen, with those weighty comments, we will leave chapter 4. That gets us ready for chapter 5, which will be the song of Deborah and Barak celebrating this famous victory. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.